Thanks, folks. It's great to be here. Thank you for turning out. I've forgotten about the Big Ego trip. It's nearly 10 years old now, and colleagues used to say to me, ask me whether I'd written a biography with that title, you know, the Big Ego trip. It must be about yourself, Glyn. So, and it wasn't far off, as my wife would tell you. So anyway, it's great to be here. As Jeremy said, I was a psychiatrist, I was an academic, and that meant my life was split into three, really. Some clinical, which obviously as academic demands got bigger toward the end, got less so, but I've always been a practicing clinician, and then quite a lot of research, and then some teaching as well. So those are the three strands that went together. But a big part of my life's always been my faith as well. And one of the wonderful things since I retired a few years back now has been having, because I was a full-on academic, I had less time, but having retired now to explore the kind of interface between psychology and mental health in a bit more detail, a bit more thoughtfulness. And I love the opportunity to come out and talk about some of these things, particularly as the way they impact faith, but also they impact on those people who are not people of faith, but are maybe thinking about some of the issues in play here. So thanks so much again. It's just great to be here. I want to say, whenever I'm talking about kind of, you know, things that impact on us personally, we've got a huge subject here. I'm going to talk for about half an hour, that's all. You know, the people are hurting in different ways, different times of life. And if that's you, I just want to say, if I say something offhand or off the cuff, you know, please bear with me. You know, it's easy to make kind of broad brush strokes and you think, crumbs, this guy's got no idea if he thinks that this can be summarized in, you know, a couple of sentences. He doesn't know anything about my life. Just let me say, I think I know, I've talked to enough people to know that how complex our lives are. And so I don't want to sound offhand and dismissive. And so please bear with me on that, because nevertheless, we've got a big topic and a short amount of time. But hopefully we've got time for questions. And if you want to push back, challenge, chip in, that's what that's about. Because a lot of these issues, you know, are open for conversation. They're not on tablets of stone, some of the points I'll be making. Okay, so me culture, is our self-obsessed age fueling a crisis in mental health? Well, a guy called Ed Koch, who's mayor of New York, colorful guy back in the 80s, was well known for his unique brand of greeting. Gripping you firmly by the hand, he'd say, "Hey, how am I doing?" Which kind of was a clever twist on the New Yorkers, "How are you doing?" which was popularized by Joey over here, wasn't it, especially. But it also tells us what politicians who need to get reelected worry about all of the time. How am I doing? What do you think of me? Well, a few of us here are going to run for office, but the research literature on self-esteem suggests that unconsciously, we're all asking that question. Every day, in almost every human encounter, how am I doing? What do you think of me? It's what the political theorist Francis Fukuyama calls the struggle for recognition. Now, we're here tonight to talk about what we're calling today's me culture. And in many ways, this goes right to the heart of it, doesn't it? And there's nothing new either. Is there in this struggle for recognition? How am I doing? Plato, Republic, he has Socrates in conversation. They're talking about the three divisions of the human psyche, the human soul. And he said there's the intellect, there's the seat of the emotions. But the third part he called thumos or thymos, which is the seat of our desire for recognition. That's Plato. For dignity, for worth, for significance. just about 300 years later, head over to Palestine, and we find a young Jewish preacher, Jesus of Nazareth, with his tiny band of followers. A dispute's broken out between them. Do you know what the dispute? It's about which one in his coming kingdom of his disciples is going to be the greatest. Fast forward 1800 years, year 1798, to Adam Smith, the father of modern economics. He wrote this in his book, The Wealth of the Nations, which I've never read, by the way. But he wrote this. To what purpose is all the toil and bustle of this world? What is the end of greed and ambition, of the pursuit of wealth and power and preeminence? Is it to supply food and drink and clothes? No. The wages of the poorest laborer can supply these. What then are the advantages of that great purpose of human life we call bettering our condition? What drives us on to get more stuff? He says it's this. This is the economists. To be observed, he said. To be attended to. To be noticed. Well, it seems wherever human beings form themselves into social groups, we find breaking out the struggle for recognition. Hey, how am I doing? So nothing new. And yet, has there ever been a period of history that seems more obsessed with this question than today? I'm not sure there has been. Listen to the American philosopher Michael Alan Fox. He said, "We live in an age of self-obsession. Everywhere we look, we encounter a preoccupation, an absorption with self-interest, self-development, self-image, self-satisfaction, self-love, self-expression, self-acceptance, self-help, self..." The list goes on. Well, there's something in that, isn't there? The age of the self. So how do we get here? What are the tributaries of the historical river that's got it? And I love this, and it's conjecture, of course, and there are lots of things we can land on, but cultural analysis, let's just spend a few minutes thinking about how we got to where we are today, because I think there are three strands. Let's think of this as a cord with three strands to it. It's the development of the age of the big me. First strand, socioeconomic developments over the past 200 years. Okay, this is big, broad brushstroke, but here we go. Socioeconomics. You see, before the Industrial Revolution, your sense of yourself, what we call our identity today, was much more established, much more stable and predictable than it is now. Isn't it? Wasn't it? People lived in stable, traditional communities. Think of it like a river. Communities that carried you along with the current. And you had a sense of where the river was coming from, its source, where it was going to, and where you sat in the kind of general scheme of things. My name's Jim Baker, you'd say. And I'm a baker. And my father was a baker, and his father was a baker, and as far as I can see ahead, we're going to be bakers because that's our family tradition. Stability. And so we didn't need to angst about how we put together the different bits of ourselves in some sort of coherent whole that we'd call our identity. The bits were pretty stable. Now, fast forward to today in modern societies, much more mobile. I couldn't be speaking in a better place to be making this point. Much more mobile. Most of you are going to be off out of here in 3-4 years. Geographically, relationally, friendships that you're forging now will change. New people coming into your lives. And this isn't a river. This is like being afloat in a vast ocean. And in a vast ocean, you can go in any direction you like. With modern technologies, you can invent and reinvent yourself every day of the week, if that's what you choose. So we're swimming in an ocean today. And so this question of who am I and the sources of the self that I put together to tell the story of the self, they're in flux. They're unstable. They're coming and going. And just as we settle on one formula, one story, new issues come along and new possibilities are presented and sold to us. And they glisten and they glow. And anyway, we saw how somebody on Facebook just posted how they're doing on that. And so we need to, and it's an ocean. So that's the first strand, socio-political developments, economic developments. But let's go to the second strand, the evolution of ideas. And there's one philosopher who's probably had more than any other one philosopher probably more than any other who's helped prepare the ideological ground for today's me culture. And I'm particularly interested in him as a psychiatrist, and you'll see why in a moment. He was born in 1844, a great friend of Wagner. He was the son of a Lutheran pastor, actually. Very religious family, but he soon threw off his parents' religion to embrace the fashionable atheism of the day. Feuerbach particularly was an influence. And brilliant academically, he gained his university professorship aged 24. But he always had a bit of an odd personality, a strange person. He never really made his mark in the academy. And it was the last few years of his life. It wasn't until into his 40s that some of his writings began to bubble up to the surface and be given some publicity. But he spent the final 10 years of his life in a mental institution where he'd sunk into a severe and profound psychosis. Who are we talking about? We could have chosen Karl Marx as a big influence in our thinking here, but not him. No. Sorry? Who are we thinking about?
Nietzsche.
Thank you. Friedrich Nietzsche, the German philosopher. And I hope you don't know too much about him either. I've probably got a philosophy kind of PhD sitting at the back there, which has now got me worried. But Nietzsche, like one of the most important figures, as I say, in understanding how we got where we are today. His most famous quotation, "God is dead," he said, "and we killed him." You heard that? "God is dead," it's most famous, "and we killed him." Now, what did he mean by that? Well, there's nothing new in his personal atheism, that's for sure. It was almost fashionable at the time amongst intellectual elites. No. What was new was his willingness to grasp the consequences of his atheism. You can't have it both ways, he argued. That's what he confronted us with. For most of Western thought, you see, God serves as the foundation for objective truth and objective moral reason. God is the supreme reason, and the truths we intuit in the world, it was thought, are ultimately grounded in God. And if God is dead, he says, you can't keep the foundation. That's the point. You can't continue to rely upon some world of objective value, of absolute truth. You can't appeal to some external tribunal to adjudicate between one idea and another. There's your truth, I've heard that, my truth. Familiar? He advocated what he called perspectivalism. There's one way of looking at things, and then there's another. There's nothing like the truth. In a world of ideas, he said, there's just ideas and power. And the ideas that bubble up to the top are those that attract the attention of the people with the power to push them. with those who hold the power. So what's Nietzsche's remedy for little old you and me swimming in our sea and our ocean? How am I doing? Hey, how am I doing? Well, he advocated that we face this bleak world with the power of the will. I assert my own will, he said. In the absence of truth, I define the truth. I make the truth. I assert the truth. The term he coined, which has gained some coinage, is the Übermensch, the Superman. I rise above the powers that seek to control me and oppress me and push me down and influence me and shoehorn me into their preconceived patterns, just the people who hold the power. And I assert the power of the will, my will. It's the primacy of will over reason. Listen, I quote Nietzsche. He said, no one can construct for you the bridge upon which precisely you must cross the stream of life. No one but yourself alone. He went on, become the person you are. Sound familiar? Friends, everybody, this is visible on our streets today. You be you. Hey, just need to be yourself. Look inside. Be the self you truly are. You be you. It's also Nietzsche. And Nietzsche has had a profound impact on what I think I'd come to call the inward turn in history, that the way in which our human relatedness has turned inward upon ourselves these past few decades. Meaning, purpose, identity found within the self. Okay, so that's our second strand to our cord. The third comes from the field of psychology. Morris Rosenberg, probably the name most identified with this movement, but there were lots of names appearing around the same time in the 50s and 60s. And Morris Rosenberg and some others were key to the development and progress of the self-esteem movement, which really took off about the 1960s. In fact, the term was coined more by, certainly popularized more by William James back in the 19th century, but it was really in the 50s and 60s that, as a movement, self-esteem got going. By the year 2000, the concept of self-esteem was among the three top most researched topics in academic psychology. Back in 40 years ago, 1960, according to the LexisNexis database, there were just 200 or 300 articles a year on self-esteem in magazines and popular publications in the US. By the year 2000, you could count 35,000 articles per year in the US alone. So what is the self-esteem movement? Well, at one level, everybody, it's a stroke of genius. Self-esteem is the value, the worth we attribute to ourselves. You see, there's something very special about you and I, as human beings. Our capacity for self-awareness is extraordinary. That the I pulls back from the me and says, what is this thing? Who is this person? The I speaks of the me. And of course, the next question, because we're profoundly evaluative as human beings, is, and how much are they worth? What is their significance? Where do they sit in the scheme of things? And of course, the problem every one of us faces as we ask that question of ourselves, what am I worth, is, well, what is going to be the basis of my calculation? What do I rely on? And so we instinctively, not knowing the answer to that, look to others to supply the answer to the question. The struggle for recognition. But then, as the self-esteem movement rightly observed, and here's the genius of it, when you do that, when you look to others to tell you your significance and worth and dignity, you're running on a treadmill, because people are fickle. As we try to impress them, as we strive to achieve, to get their attention, for them to notice us, to recognize us, to give us dignity and worth. And they give us their attention one day, but tomorrow somebody else has attracted it. And all of the stardom, this is what's so hard for celebrities, you see. They're in the spotlight, they walk the red carpet, they're at the very pivot of their careers, and the attention of the world feels to be on them. And friends, it is intoxicating. It's even intoxicating when people look your way. Somebody like me, this is why people do it and stand out at the front. It's one of the drivers, because we like it when people look your way, when they recognize you. It's profoundly intoxicating to the human spirit. But the problem is, what happens when they stop looking and they grow tired and somebody else is younger, cleverer, better than you? And it's the whole problem of contingency. This is contingent self-worth. It's self-worth which you have hooked to the approval of other people. And so you are captive to them. Because you see, what happens when you do that, when they make you redundant and you can't earn their esteem anymore, or you get old, or you get ill, disabled? Now what are you worth? You've just got to keep on running, haven't you? How am I doing? It's the boom or bust ego. I remember somebody telling me, you know the high jump, she said? Why would anybody ever want to do the high jump? She said, what a sport. She said, because what do they do? You do all that work for it. You finally get over the bar. What do they do next? They always push the bar higher. And she said, my father was like that. And no matter how hard I tried to win his esteem and his approval and to gain from him some sort of foundation of confidence, whenever I got a yes, but then he always pushed the bar higher, it was a no. And I've been jumping ever since. And I need somebody to help me to stop jumping for him. And there's the problem. Self-esteem that hangs on a thread, constantly vulnerable, always at risk, only as ever as good as your last jump, ultimately contingent. Hey, how am I doing? And you see, there's our problem. If it's not a good idea to chase the ego highs of other people's approval, and if God is dead and we have killed him, where do we go? Here's the genius of the self-esteem movement. It says you approve yourself. That's where you go. Hey, Nietzsche, look inside yourself and you say what you're worth. The self, I, esteems itself. It's pure genius. It's the only reliable way to get off the treadmill of their approval. You award it to yourself. It's the ultimate non-contingency, because it relies only on the force of your own will and your own power. And today, this ideology is everywhere about us. Every school prize-giving speech, done it myself. Every Oscar acceptance speech. every new stage musical, every new Netflix. Be yourself. Discover yourself. Find myself. I couldn't believe it recently. I was listening to Andrew Lloyd Webber talking about his new Cinderella musical. Has anybody been to see that here? Any confession? Wompa, that's very brave. Actually, there's more than you've been, but they just don't put their hands up. Was it good? Was it?
Very good, yeah.
Yeah, it was good. Okay, well, help me overcome my prejudices. Anyway, I was listening to him, and he said he had the script writer with him, and he said, we want to do something really different. We wanted a different angle on Cinderella. And I thought, you know. And he said, you know, when we come up with this great idea, he said, tell them, you see. And he turned to the script writer, and she said, well, we wanted something different. I thought, oh, no, it's going to be. She said, we just wanted Cinderella to kind of discover herself. I thought, no, that's the oldest story in the world now. You know, please, new musical, give us something new, something different. But it's everywhere around us. I am my own experiment, sings Madonna. I am my own work of art. And what not to like? So what's the problem? Problem is there's no evidence this works as a strategy. Now, if you want to talk about some of the evidence in detail, come and talk to me afterwards. But let me tell you about one study that I think illustrates this particularly well. It's by Joanna Wood, University of Ontario. It's published about 8 years ago now. And I thought she set up a really nice trial. And there were three arms to the trial. Her subjects, as in every other psychological experiment in the world, were students. That's the only people psychologists ever look at, believe me, students. Anyway, she took a lot of students. And first of all, she got a sense for how often these students used self-affirming statements. You know, I'm special. I attract people to myself. I have resources deep inside myself which bring energy, dynamism into every human encounter I make. You know, those positive. And, you know, these are particularly North American, but they're really quite commonly used as a means of affirming, boosting our self-esteem, you see. And so she said, randomized them into three groups. The first group, she gave a bunch of these self-affirming statements. And she said, here's the task for the next 3 months. I want you, and you're going to have to journal this every day, 20 minutes, 30 minutes, you're going to meditate on these statements and appropriate them. You're going to drink them in. You're going to absorb them into your soul and make them true of you, okay? It's the first group. The second group, she said, I want you to do the same amount of time, but I want, during this period of meditation, you will say to yourself, how is this statement true of me? And how is it not true of me? Far more evaluative. The third group got nothing at all, kind of a control. So what happened when she followed them up at 3 and 6 months? Well, I'll tell you now, people always ask when I share this, what happened to the second group? So nothing happened. The second group, there's no outcome, or the third, right? No difference. But the first group, interestingly, she'd done a raft of baseline psychometrics. And then she did a raft of follow-up psychometrics at 3 and 6 months. What she found was the people who entered the study with lower self-esteem, that is, they rated themselves as unworthy, they rated themselves as lower on confidence, originality, those kind of factors. At the end of the 3 months of boosting, actually felt worse about themselves, and they scored lower on other indicators of general mental health. And she summarized her findings and said that self-affirming statements seem to help a little people who already feel good about themselves. So if you're Donald Trump, you go in feeling good and you come out feeling better after doing these. See? But if you've got low self-esteem, she said, they seem to backfire for the people who need them most. Why? And this isn't her words, it's mine. Because it's just your own propaganda. We reach inside ourselves and we dredge up from the value that we can from there. But something about us says, this isn't enough. It's not enough. I need more. And this brings us to the question in our title, the link with today's crisis in mental health, because rather than making us into outward-looking, confident people, ready to make something of the world and to serve the world, it seems to be turning us inward, sucking cognitive resources and energy into ourselves and out of the world. Psychologist Jennifer Crocker done some beautiful work on this, and she showed how people who have a focus on maintaining their self-esteem, their sense of self-worth, seem to have an eroded capacity for what others are feeling. Their empathy is reduced. Why? Because your cognitive resources are being marshaled to maintain your own sense of self-esteem. You haven't got time to listen to this person droning on about her marriage. You see, it's about me. It's about me. Carol Dweck shows how this inward turn leads children to be risk-averse. The desire to cast themselves as a winner reduces our willingness to expose ourselves to the challenge that might just prove that we're a bit of a loser. And so we protect ourselves and withdraw ourselves from risk. And instead of building confident, outward-looking young men and women who want to go out and make something of the world, it produces vulnerable, fragile, inner spirits that are seeking protection and safety. And intolerant of opposition, we band ourselves into groups and fracture into tribal identity groups, demanding protection and approval and affirmation. Now, we can argue about the data, the validity of some of the psychological evidence, but something tells us that today's me culture, doesn't it? If it's not the cause, it's probably not the solution to today's problem of the self. So I just want to wind up just now, and you've been very patient with me, thank you. I just want to wind up by asking, what the world of faith, and I'm coming to this as someone who, in a marketplace of ideas, which this is tonight, someone who wants to set up my stall and just share part of what I think the Christian faith brings to the table on this. And I want to suggest that at its core, the Christian message is radically countercultural in terms of what it brings to the table. And if you're a Christian here, I just want to really encourage you. We need to rediscover our confidence in saying we've got another story here that speaks into me culture. And that story is founded on three key messages, okay? I'm going to give you them now. First, yes, we need to look inside ourselves. But let's be honest about what we find. I sold my car about 2.5 years ago, 10 years old banger, to one of these websites like WeBuyAnyCar.com for a zillions of pounds, you know. And then if ever you do take your car along, do not believe the price they tell you on their website, okay? Because every scratch is £500 off. So let me warn you. But I had a lovely guy who did his best not to count too many scratches. Let's call him Jack. And we got talking afterwards as he was ready to eke out my measly check for my beautiful old car at the end. And I sensed he hadn't been in London all that long. He'd come from overseas. And so I said, so what brought you to London then? And what brought you into this job especially? I could see this was a temporary thing. He was heading elsewhere. He said, I don't know why I came to London, really. I guess to find myself, he said. I don't know what made me say it, and I just said, but what happens if the self you find you don't like very much? What then? And he said, do you want to go for a coffee? So we went for a coffee. But there's a great deal of talk there about authenticity being real. And I'd want to say the Christian story, the Christian faith says, yeah, look inside yourself. You must do that because you're a beautiful creature made in the image of God. And God wants to deal with you as a unique individual with a unique contribution to make to his world. So look inside yourself and understand yourself, but be honest about what you find. And I look, friends, when I look inside myself and I want to be honest, I see some really good stuff. I think I'm gifted in some areas. I see some real beauty. I see some good intentions, genuine good intentions in there. But if you want me to be real, I see selfishness and unkindness. And I have a self-pleasing and people-using side to me. And if I'm honest with you, and there's things I don't want to tell you about that sometimes feel as if they've got their roots in hell in my soul. And lots more. And it's what the Bible calls sin, which I define as our human propensity to screw things up. Sin, our human propensity to screw up, the crack that runs through everything. That's what we find. You know, in today's identity politics, we approach the world as if the line dividing good and evil runs between groups of people, your group and my group. No, said Alexander Solzhenitsyn. He said, the line separating good and evil passes not through states, nor between classes, nor between political parties either, but right through every human heart and through all human beings. I think he was right. Now, you know, the Christian faith is all about Jesus Christ, back to that Palestinian preacher. And Jesus, he didn't gloss over the realities of what we find when we look inside either. He took on the powerful religious leaders of his day. And in front of crowds of ordinary people, he called them out as whitewashed sepulchres, tombs. He said, you look great on the outside with all the gold lettering and the fine words like the tombs. But inside, it's a body of decay and you know it. Hey, how am I doing? Well, from the inside out, he would have said to them, not very well. And the ordinary people, when they saw how Jesus took on the religious police and the racketeers and the oligarchs, they cheered him on, at least his own disciples, until he turned round to them and said, why do you look at the speck of sawdust in your brother's eye? And pay no attention to the plank in your own? You hypocrites. First, take the plank out of your own eye. We're all in this together, the crack that runs through everything. So the Christian faith says, look inside yourself, yes, but be honest. And then second, what you find inside yourself is indeed what you are. But the Christian faith says it's not who you are. You must never be defined by what you find there. Now, I don't know where you're coming from tonight, but if you're somebody who says, but I don't know God, I just want to say the Christian faith says, but he knows you. And you're absolutely known by God, loved by God, and he's reaching out to you tonight. And let me read a few words from one of the gospel accounts of Jesus' life, can I? It's just a few words, and it's Matthew chapter 1. Jesus is walking beside the Sea of Galilee, and he saw Simon and his brothers Andrew casting a net into the lake, for they were fishermen. Come, follow me, Jesus said, and I will send you out to fish for people. It's been called one of the worst puns in human history, but there you go. And I will send you out to fish for people. And at once they left their nets and followed him. Here's two guys minding their own business. And as they go about earning a living, something happens to them. They hadn't come looking for Jesus or paid a fee or done some special program. Jesus turned up in their lives and he upends all their preconceptions and he calls them by name. And he says, follow me. And it's a beautiful cameo of the essence of the Christian life. You see, the Christian life isn't grounded in our own exertions. We don't get right with God. We don't restore a relationship with him by trying. Hey, God, how am I doing? Am I going to church enough? Am I good enough? It can look like that from the front end, as if we're striving toward God. But you talk to folk who've been Christians for a few years, no matter how they became a Christian, they'll tell you there's time passes by. They'll say, I felt at the time I was searching for God, but I can see now he was searching for me. He knew me. And being known by God is who we are. And you notice how Jesus doesn't say, well, guys, go home, come back when you've reached a higher spiritual plane. He doesn't say, oh, come back when you've cleaned up your lives, guys. He says yes to them. Yes, as precious human beings, just where they are, just as they stand with the crack that runs through everything in their lives. And he's not going to paper over the cracks. Believe me, he's not going to paper over the cracks. You hypocrites, he said. Why do you, the plank in your own eye? No, there's not going to be any papering over the cracks. But as they follow him, they'll follow him to the cross in which he takes all of that crackedness and draws it into his own broken self for them to put things right, to restore their relationship with God. And that is who they are. You know, many years later, Peter, one of those people we're reading about just here, Simon becomes Peter. He was trying to help a young early Christian church who were being persecuted. And, you know, people turning up at the house, dragging people off. People taking away their livelihoods, driving them out into the streets. And he was trying to help them. He said, when they persecute you, he said, thank God that you're a Christian and that you bear that name. It's a beautiful text. Thank God that you bear that name, Christian, because that is what defines you. So yes, we are what we find, but we are not who we find in there. We're loved by God, known by God, and a God who longs to put together that relationship with us once more. And then finally, and this really is a last paragraph, believe me, the third message, I think this is fantastic. Your life is not about you. It's one of the great gifts of the Christian faith. Your life is not about you. What did Jesus say to these guys? Follow me. Follow me. I can barely think of anything more radical, more challenging for today's me culture. If you're a Christian here, stand up tall in this, because it is life for the world. Your life is not about you. God accepts us as we are in the Christian story. He doesn't leave us as we are, because it's not about us. He invites us to step out of the dull, flat landscape of our ego drama into a story bigger than ourselves. Carol Crocker, who I mentioned earlier, this is the whole direction of travel of her research, actually. She says this inward turn of the ego that depletes our resources, our cognitive resources to engage with the world, that sucks us away from the world, he said. The only solution, she said, is that we need to find a story that is bigger than ourselves, in which we can participate and in participate become ourselves. But we become ourselves not by focusing in on ourselves, but by contributing to something bigger beyond ourselves. Now, as a secular person, she says, I don't know what that bigger story should be. She says, maybe being an eco-warrior, and it's a lot better than nothing. But here in the Christian story is, you get to participate in God's big story, a kingdom marked by goodness and beauty and truth, elements which have their grounding in the person of God himself. And he says, now orientate your lives toward these higher values of goodness, beauty, and truth, and love, and contribute to this world of value and purpose, and bring your own unique gift to it. But it's not about you. It's about something bigger. Lose yourself in it. I'm going to stop there. Come back to me with questions, pushback, thoughts later on, but I'll hand back to you, Jeremy, just now. Thank you.
Guys, why don't you give Glenn a massive round of applause? Okay, what would you say to someone who finds it hard to see their own value to the point that they feel suicidal? What if you can see the value in others, but never in yourself?
Right. I'll be honest with you, I'd say, can we have a long talk about this? Because I wouldn't want to produce some little scripted, potted answer. You know, behind every question, there's a big story and a long journey. And I just want to find out a bit more what's going on behind that. I often get these kind of questions. What would you say to someone like this, or what would you say to someone like that? And then, of course, I discover that we're talking about someone's sister who is going to go home and tell her, well, I was just listening to this psychiatrist, and he said, people like you need to, you know, and give the thing. So I'm very wary. People are too beautiful, too rich and wonderful. But, you know, there is a point in a conversation, in a series of conversation, which I want to lead someone to stand back from this embedded thought of themselves as someone who has no worth, and look at where that came from, and then begin to find the confidence to put that under the microscope, examine it, and tell a different story. Okay, what the Christian faith does, I think, is God values you in a way that is ultimately grounding. You know, it doesn't mean he affirms everything about you. It doesn't mean that you haven't got loads to learn. It doesn't mean that you've got some real weaknesses and other people have strengths. It doesn't mean any of that, but it means that you are loved and grounded as a human being. He knows you, and it's in that being known, I think, that you get this foundation of the self on which you then build your gifts and develop your abilities. But if you're not a Christian, that's a tougher journey, but it's still possible. You use the wisdom that can be found in the world through turning outward, finding that you can love, you do have things to contribute, and in the interplay between those things, you develop a better foundation for the self. But many of these self-talk ideas, I'm no good, have been sculpted out of quite negative, destructive early relationships. I remember talking to a woman not long ago, an old, you know, a woman nearly my age, so quite ancient, and she was saying, she said it was my mother's, I think her mission in life was to pull me down as a kid and corrode my sense of confidence. She said that was her purpose in life. And she didn't say it with bitterness, actually. She'd worked through it. She said it. That was the story. And she'd found a way through that, but there's still that feeling there, you know. And you often find things like that.
Right.
But not always. Not always. Everyone's different story.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I feel like every time you give an answer, there are lots of questions that could be asked more. Like, if you want to keep having that conversation. But something's come up a couple of times here is a couple of people have asked almost, we've talked quite narrowly around this idea of self-esteem and identity. But the question, we also talked about a crisis in mental health in general. And a couple of people are saying, which is even, I think this question's even harder in a way, but what would it give us any thoughts you have, which is essentially, what does the Christian faith have to say to the wider topic of mental health? I don't know how you want to say that, but a couple of people have asked that. Like, where I think they've specifically mentioned depression, anxiety here, but there may be other things you want to speak to.
Yeah, again, these are tough questions. It's a bit like saying, what does the Christian faith have to say about, you know, the field of physical illness?
Yeah.
You know, it's a huge area. And I just hate handing out these, you know, bland statements. But I think what the Christian faith does is, first of all, it teaches that we are embodied beings, that the body is something created by God, given by God. And as our bodies, through what Christians understand to be the fall, the brokenness of our world that's happened, our bodies go wrong in various ways. So there are organic contributory factors to our psyche and the way we operate and think and feel. And those processes, those regulatory processes of the brain can become just as disordered as our liver or our kidney. So actually, the Christian faith validates an instinct that we have, that it's not all in the mind, but it's in our body as well. And it's not all in our body, it's also in our mind. But I think that's the first point, that the organic, the physical perspective on mental health is a valid perspective within the Christian faith. Otherwise, I would have left psychiatry, you know, long ago. There wouldn't have been any meaning for that. I think it also testifies to the complexity of our humanity. If you look in the Christian scriptures, for example, there are the most extraordinary family sagas in there, and there's an extraordinary recognition of the pain that goes with living in this world in which there are so many cracks running through our relationships. Mm. And there's a sense in the scriptures of understanding that, I think. I think one of the most precious verses for me is I wonder whether you've ever thought of this. God, you know, God hasn't introduced himself to us as the eternal light. We don't pray to the eternal light or the unfathomable darkness. Call me Father. It's a profound gift of the Christian faith that God reaches down into our lives. And in one of the Psalms, it says God is filled with compassion for us. He knows that we are dust. That's beautiful. You know, it's that God allows some space for our dustiness, our crackness, our struggle, our weaknesses. And he bears with it. He bears with us in these things as he leads us through our journey. And I think that's another important part. And I think, too, the Bible, in terms of mental health issues, brings some real challenges. You know, it confronts us with the kind of choices that we're making, which are self-destructive. And it also offers a worldview which is radically different. One of which I share, your life is not about you. I think that is a huge gift that the Christian faith brings to the world, and particularly to someone who's feeling, you know, that their life is just turned in on itself. It's so flat and dreary. And someone says, look inside yourself. And you think, really? Is that what I'm going to build my life on? Is that my sense of purpose? Is that what I orientate myself to? Me? Is that it? Is that why I'm here? You know, I think, no, there's so much hope in the Christian faith that that brings as well. But it's no one size fits all, no quick fix, no easy solution. But there's a friend who comes alongside us in our faith.
Wow. Okay. This is wonderful stuff. Guys, okay, who wants to go next? Let's have some questions from the floor. It's always hard to be the first one. Can I just say, as you ask a question, just try and keep it relatively brief. We want to get trying through as many as possible.
We got through those.
We've still got some in case there are no questions.
There's a guy called Elliot who asked me a question, which I said, ask me that from the floor.
Because where's Elliot?
It was a good one. Could you shout your question?
That middle, Zach?
Yeah.
Zach's going to hang on to the microphone, guys, so just let him keep holding. If you speak too long, we'll just cut you off. Right, none of that compassion.
So my question was, if one of the pitfalls for finding your worth in others is that you'll always be chasing a level that you can never obtain, and one of the pitfalls for finding worth in yourself, let's say, is that if you can affirm yourself, then there's no reason to improve. Would not these pitfalls also apply to if you find your worth in God? So, because if he's an unattainable standard, you'll continuously be working and tire yourself out. Or if he completely affirms you, there's no reason for you to improve yourself either. Is there like a way to sort of resolve that kind of situation?
Okay. Go on.
Summarize.
No, I say if God is God, like that kind of high jump person who keeps raising the bar and is an unobtainable standard, or is he just a kind of affirm, do anything, you kind of be who you are kind of thing? And if he's neither of those, which is he, and kind of how does that work as well?
You know, we construct God in our own image as well. That's why the Christian faith is a journey in which our preconceptions are challenged by how God reveals himself. And it's a journey of understanding God he is, not the God we think he is. So you can import into your relationship with God the same dysfunctions as one had, say, with one's father. And this is commonly said. You know, your father sets the bar higher, and we see God like that, and we just map one over onto the other. That is possible. It is not the God of the Bible. It's not the God that Jesus came to teach us, because he never deals with it. You know, he's compassionate. He knows that we're dust. He bears with us in our weaknesses. He puts the boot in. Believe me, he will put the boot in, because he doesn't mess about. If you're messing about with him, he'll put the boot in. This is a
I think
real...
you should translate he'll put the boot in for an international audience. I think that might be northern speak.
Is that northern?
It's it's not. It's
don't
a bit...
you talk about putting the boot in the south?
I think they're on my side.
I'll tell you, that's interesting. Because a very posh southerner that I know who was a very public school thing. And he was talking about a psychiatrist friend of mine who he went to see. And he said, boy, he can put the boot in, can't he? So I assumed, you know, if this guy said it. But anyway, it just means he doesn't mess about. You know, if you need a kick in the pants, he'll give you a kick in the pants sometime. Well, I mean, you know, the Christian faith isn't a relationship with some godfather, you know, some fairy godmother type person who's there just to affirm you. Not by any means. But he's a person of incredible warmth and kindness toward us. And his heart is turned toward us. And it's that, I think, that grounds our sense of worth, that we are ultimately loved, you see. Now, when I was talking to Elliot, I was saying earlier, that doesn't mean that you don't have to rate or give some value to your gifts and your achievements. There's nothing worse than someone, you know, and because Christians, we want to be humble, you know, and so if someone says, that was amazing, you know, the way you played the piano there, just beautiful, amazing. And they say, oh, no, it wasn't me. It was the Lord, you know. It was God who did it. And it's an attempt to be, and you want to say, wasn't that good, actually, you know. I mean, God played the piano. No. Yeah. What about who played the wrong note then? You see, and they say, oh, that was me. You know, I played the wrong note. I tell you, God is a father. No father worth his salt would ever claim all of the good notes for himself and his little boy gets the wrong note. That isn't any decent father. It's certainly not the one from whom all fatherhood is named, as the Bible calls him. So he's there for you. That doesn't mean that he doesn't want you to develop your strengths and to recognize your weaknesses. It doesn't mean that you're not enabled to say, I think I'm really good at this. You notice when I said I look inside myself, I see some good things. I meant that. I think I'm really good at some things. And I own that. It just doesn't make me a more important person than the tramp I'll step over when we leave the building. It doesn't make me one bit more important. It means I may be a good footballer, I may be a good speaker at times, I may be a good whatever, but none of that grounds who I am. Who I am is a child of God, loved to the ends of the world, and that's the basis of who I am. On that foundation, I stand and I say, I'm good at some things. I think I'm really good. I'm pretty lousy at that. And I need to work on that. Or that, I'm just always going to be lousy at, and thank God, literally, that there are other people who compensate and create a team with me, because that's part of his thing. So I think there's a wonderful liberty here. Folks, just own your strengths. Let God be pleased with your strengths. You know, when I run, I feel his pleasure. You must do that. If you're good at stats, if you're good at a computer, if you're good relationally at work, you know, feel his pleasure in what you do. Just as when you mess up and you screw up, you come in repentance and you find his forgiveness as well. That's the genius of the Christian faith. It grounds us in that way, but then sends us into God's world to add to it and to make something of it with him.
Who else would like to ask a question? We've got one up front here. Any other questions as well? Zach's going to come to busy, but raise your hand if you've got a question as well, just so you can kind of keep mind of that. Go on, busy.
All right, sorry, mate. COVID. So we were talking about how, like, how we resonate with the idea of the treadmill, and you're kind of like trying to please the people around you, and that your value is determined on how they affirm you. Can you speak a bit into how this whole idea of societal affirmation with things like cancel culture and stuff like that, the danger of, I guess, that when you could build your whole life and value, like let's say someone like J.K. Rowling or these type of things, where everything you've done that had a worth and a value can be just undone in a second, and it's gone from, like, it's not just then the self or the people around you. There's this whole next level, societal level. And yeah, just I wonder what you said into kind of cancel culture and how that relates to this.
Yeah, the trouble is cancel culture is so powerful because it senses how vulnerable and fragile we are, and how much we depend on or seek the approval of other people. That's its power. That's why it chills our speech. I haven't got an easy answer, because although the Christian journey is about discovering that we're grounded in God's love, it is a journey. You know, I'm 73 nearly, folks, you know, and I still hunger for people's approval. And I've been talking about this for years, and I still find myself drifting, you know, toward, will you love me? Will you like me? Since I was a little boy, and it's still there. So we all struggle with these things. You struggle, I struggle. But what the Christian journey is, it is a journey. And I'm learning, and I'm working at it. And one day, of course, the great promise of the Christian faith is that what we desire for ourselves, what we really want, to be free of that, falls into line with reality as God, at the end of all things, establishes his kingdom. And suddenly we find that what we desire is who we are. There's a beautiful symmetry. There's a beautiful roundedness to who we are. Meanwhile, cancel culture knows that, you know, you're on the journey, or if you're not a Christian as well, these are tough things. And I can only say that when it happens to you, and it happened nearly to a friend of mine, a younger guy as an academic recently, it is really hard, because your friends pull away from you. No one wants to be contaminated. You're sucked into a powerful dynamic of feeling that, you know, you've been, a sacrifice is needed, and you're it, and you're offered up. And people pull, you know, if you know anyone like that, all I can say is stand with them as far as you can. You know, ring them up, be their friend. People need friends when it happens to them, unless they've been stupid and unless they put their foot in it. Even then, they need friends, but you're going to have to be careful then, depending on what they've said. But, you know, stand with your friends. I think that's a really important thing. But I'm not going to pretend that just being a Christian somehow protects you from the power of cancel culture. It doesn't. But if we don't push back against it, I really fear. Because it's conspiring with our tendency now to corral ourselves into identity groups and demand recognition and see the line between good and evil as running between groups and not through every heart, as we as Christians think. Yeah. It's a great question, that. I wish I had a really cool, smart answer to it, but, you know.
That's great. Let's have one more from the floor. Lady at the front.
So I just want to go back to what you said earlier about God getting pleasure when you are thriving and flourishing, and just how you balance that with self-development, right? And this concept of improving areas of yourself where you're weak, and especially for those who might have this view of like a father figure who keeps setting the bar higher, how you balance that in your relationship with God, where it's not a performance type relationship, but he wants you to be the best version of yourself.
And sorry, and did you get, was, what was the question?
Essentially, how do you trade off between
self-development and relating with God as a father who wants you to thrive and flourish in your strengths, but also develop the areas where you might be weaker?
Yeah, I such a precious word in the Bible is wisdom. We always want rules. We, you know, we want the information, we want the rules. That's 12 rules for life. You know, we want the rules. So many things in life have to be negotiated with wisdom. Wisdom where you're balancing two competing and conflicting demands at times. And sometimes you have to, your wisdom has to encourage you to give one bit more. You know, I need to really work on this. At other times, you think, I'm getting a bit slavishly achieving, trying to live up to standard, trying to earn my way back into my father's, you know. And so you say, no, I need to pull back. I'm going to, you know, let go a bit of that. And so it's about wisdom, different strategies for different things. I think. Sorry, I haven't. It's a big question. Again, I always want to say, so what's, just give me some examples. What's the story? What are we, you know, talking about here? But yeah.
Okay. I'd like to ask one final question, if that's okay. Earlier on, you were talking about the kind of being grounded in the love of God. And as you were speaking, I was just reflecting on the fact there'll be many here who, that's a very alien concept to them. This kind of, maybe just they, when they hear it, they hear words. And I just wonder if, I almost want to kind of say, what does it feel like? Or rather, could you give us, for those who where it just, where it feels like what you're describing is a really alien idea, how can you help them understand what you're talking about?
Yeah, that's an amazing question, really. And it would be a great kind of talk, seminar.
We've got another app.
Yes. and the first thing, of course, is that we're all different. We all experience love in different ways, relationally, as you know, the languages of love. There's something in that. There's quite a lot in it. Some of us prefer to experience love through a very different modality to somebody else. For example, my wife, gifts don't do it for her. No.
You don't have to spend very much money at Christmas or birthday or Valentine's. Great.
I spent my life trying to convince her, you know, let me buy you this. But there are other things the little thoughtful things, actually. And so we learn with each other, don't we? It's actually the, I think it's the, God relates to us through our existing psyche and ways of relating. And so we'll learn to experience his love in the same ways. But, you know, it's not easy to think about how we experience the love of God. It comes through teaching. That's why we come to church. We hear about, you know, when we say, well, how do I know he loves me? Someone says, well, what he's done, for goodness sake, you know? And it's the same with God. Well, look what he's done. Look who he is. Look what he says. All of that is pointing in your direction. And so he comes at us through our rationality and through what he's done. But he comes to us, too, relationally. I remember a few years back, I was suffering with something called shingles, and the pain was excruciating. And I went on a morphine in the end with it. And that just depressed me profoundly. And I remember looking at the window in the bedroom and thinking, do you know, I've been teaching medical students all these years that when someone says, I really feel I don't want to live anymore, that is a dark tunnel. And so I've been telling people that. I think I know what that is. I think for the first time in my life, I think I know what that looks like. And it was a very attractive looking window all of a sudden. And then a few minutes later, my wife comes in and says, this friend of ours, wife, she didn't know you were ill actually, but she just felt she should, there's some flowers for you. And she just wanted to give you these, you know. Now that is unusual. It doesn't happen every day in the Christian faith, but you open yourself up, your awareness, your perspective changes so that you see God coming at you in some ways. He comes at you through friends. Your wife has a baby. People turn up with food and gifts. You know, in all kinds of ways, God loves us. But sometimes, some of you here, you'll have had very emotionally closed experiences of life, and that'll be partly your personality, partly your experience. And I've sat now, I've said, you know, sat with people, I said, you've got to let God love you. You work so hard. You think he's never satisfied. You're always slaving away. He's not like that. Let him love you. And I want them to hear his voice in my voice at that point. So he comes at us through each other. He comes at us just in the mystery of prayer, of the mystery of taking bread and wine at church, you know? You know, when you come for bread and wine, hear God say, for you, It's not this piece of bread. It's not for him. It's for you. It's given for you, broken for you. My body, feed on it, gnaw on it. It's for you, broken for you. Let him do that. Hear him speak. Let him love you. So I think there are those different ways that God comes to us, and 1,000 others, I guess.
That's amazing. Guys, why don't you give in another round of applause?